Welcome to SNC's podcast series, SNC Critical Insights. I'm Julie Jordan, and I'm co-head of Sullivan & Cromwell's Workplace Investigations Practice. Today, we're going to be talking about sexual harassment investigations in light of the Me Too movement. I'm with Diane McGimsey, who is also a partner in our Workplace Investigations Practice.
Thanks, Julie. I wanted to start us off with a little bit of context for why we thought this would be an interesting discussion to have today. Obviously, complaints in the workplace about sexual harassment aren't a new thing, but since the Me Too movement exploded in the fall of 2017, the headlines have been replete with Me Too allegations from seemingly every industry, with numerous departures of prominent executives as a result of such allegations, and what appears to be a clear uptick in sexual harassment complaints. Given this environment and some recent changes in the laws relating to sexual harassment complaints, one topic that seems to be coming up more and more in our practice is whether the Me Too movement has changed how companies should respond to complaints of sexual harassment. Have you started to see changes in how companies are handling these types of complaints?
Yes, Dan, I think they have. I mean, I believe most employers today now have a heightened sensitivity to the perils of not appropriately responding to sexual harassment complaints, which in turn, of course, has affected how those complaints and the resulting investigations are being handled by companies. There is now greater appreciation that a company's response to a complaint, including the actual investigation itself, at times can come under as much criticism as the conduct that led to the complaint. The legal landscape concerning sexual harassment allegations has also changed. The issue of whether or not employers can or should include a confidentiality provision or a so-called NDA to resolve such complaints has been widely discussed, and legislation has been adopted in certain jurisdictions that not only addresses that particular issue, but also how an employer should otherwise respond to a sexual harassment complaint. For example, take the state of New York. They now require employers to adopt a sexual harassment prevention policy that contains certain elements, including specifically a procedure for the timely and confidential investigation of complaints and due process for all parties.
So even though we're going to be talking today about some best practices for sexual harassment investigations, it's important to always remind yourself at the outset that sexual harassment can take many forms. Among other things, they can include making unwelcome sexual advances, derogatory comments or jokes, physical touching, or using sexually degrading words. In light of that, there's no standard template for how you conduct a sexual harassment investigation, and they can take many different shapes and sizes. Although each investigation has to be tailored to its facts, the Me Too movement has underscored that every investigation needs to be credible. In other words, it needs to be objective, thorough, and documented. The movement has also shown that a company cannot tolerate conduct that deviates from acceptable workplace conduct from any individual, even the so-called superstar harasser, meaning someone who's key to the financial performance of the company. Some people even argue that individuals who hold such positions of power should be held to a higher standard, given that the tone or culture of a company starts at the top. Given that backdrop, Julie, what are the key issues that an employer should be addressing at the outset of any investigation into a harassment claim?
So one of the threshold issues, obviously, one needs to address is who will be conducting the investigation. As you said, Diane, the movement has underscored the need to conduct credible investigations. In making this decision, one should strive to avoid the appearance of a potential conflict of interest, which could lead to the results of the review being called into question. For example, one plainly shouldn't have the person accused of the harassment having direct control over the investigation. But the results of an investigation also may be called into question if there's any suggestion that the accused may have indirect control over the investigation, whether it be through a formal chain of command or a suggestion that the person or persons being investigated may somehow be able to influence the course and results of the investigation. Just by way of example, look at the termination of Matt Lauer, where NBC conducted an extensive investigation into the issue of whether executives were aware of any prior allegations that had been made against Lauer. Among other things, NBC reportedly interviewed about 70 current and former employees, but the results of that extensive review, which found that the executives were not aware of any such complaints, were called into question by some simply because the investigation was conducted by internal counsel and was viewed as the company exonerating itself. Given the extensive press that the Lauer matter received, It leads me to yet another key consideration for an employer following the filing of a sexual harassment complaint, and that's whether to engage an outside public relations firm to assist the company not only in responding to media inquiries, but also how to internally address such a complaint or disciplinary action following an investigation of a complaint. We find often that internal communications often find themselves on their social media, given the social media presence today. To be clear, I don't believe a PR professional is needed in every single case, but it is something that should be considered at the outset, particularly where the allegations involve a high-level employee or what you refer to as a so-called superstar harasser, or alleged to involve systematic issues at the employer.
One other important consideration in selecting who will be conducting the investigation is whether the privilege will apply. Quite often, these types of issues come up in a context where it doesn't seem like there's necessarily a lot of financial risk, and so companies tended towards using their HR professionals to conduct these investigations. But if you use an individual to conduct the investigation who's not an attorney, such as an HR professional, or someone who's not acting under the direction of an attorney, the investigation will not be protected by the attorney-client privilege or work product doctrine, including the ultimate report itself if one is made. A third important consideration is whether you think there's going to be follow-on litigation and who you may want to handle that litigation. Having the same firm conduct your internal investigation and then also handle the follow-on litigation can sometimes put you at more risk of a privilege waiver and can also lead to questions about the partiality or impartiality of your investigation.
And given sexual harassment investigations are not one size fits all, one also needs to address at the outset the scope and purpose of the investigation. The scope of an investigation can vary greatly. I personally have been involved in investigations that have spanned from days to months, and even one case, a year. And the scope of an investigation obviously depends on the nature of the allegations and the information that you currently have in hand to address those allegations. Increasingly today, in light of the Me Too movement, we are seeing sexual harassment allegations that are quite dated, and in those instances, the information available can be limited. So at the outset of any investigation, I try to identify who should be interviewed and what documents should be preserved and reviewed. In doing so, it's important to be mindful that your initial list is not set in stone, and the scope of an investigation usually does change as the facts unfold. For example, one witness may tell you that multiple individuals witnessed the alleged harassment, leading you to add those individuals to your list of interviewees.
What exactly do you mean, Julie, when you speak about addressing the purpose of a sexual harassment investigation? I mean, what else are you doing outside of looking into the credibility of the harassment allegations?
Well, depending on the nature of the complaint, Diane, these investigations can also involve looking into whether prior complaints were received by an employer with respect to the specific employee at issue, and what, if anything, was done in response to any such complaints. Ideally, investigators should know and discuss with the employer whether this issue is within the realm or scope of their investigation at the outset. This can reduce the need for multiple interviews of the same individual so the questions can be posed at one time, and it also affects the scope of the investigation plan.
So it sounds to me, Julie, like it's very important to clearly define the scope of the investigation at the outset. But once you start conducting the investigation, do you typically limit yourself to only investigating whether the particular anti-harassment policy at issue was violated?
No, I think you have to follow the evidence. And if you come across evidence suggesting that another company policy or even a legal obligation was violated, you can't ignore it. If it's directly related to the allegations, it is generally folded into your investigation given the overlap. Just by way of example, in sexual harassment investigations that I've personally conducted, it's not uncommon to have issues relating to the improper submission of business expenses or the failure to abide by a company policy to report a romantic relationship with a coworker. If, on the other hand, allegations arise during an interview that are of completely different nature, just by way of an example, embezzlement, then it is not uncommon to conduct a separate investigation of that issue.
Another tricky issue that seems to arise more often than not is when a witness or often the complainant requests that you keep his or her name completely confidential and not identify them to anyone. Do you ever promise to keep the identity of a witness or the complainant anonymous?
Yeah, it is a tricky issue because your immediate gut reaction is you want to promise them that level of confidentiality, but you can't. An employer simply cannot guarantee an employee complete confidentiality. And in fact, the EEOC expressly recognizes that is the case in its guidance. Generally, in this type of investigation, it is difficult and sometimes impossible to conduct an effective investigation without revealing certain information to the alleged harasser and potential witnesses. As a result, when I personally conduct an investigation, I make it clear at the outset that I will protect the confidentiality of the allegations to the extent possible. And if an employer has a written policy that makes that clear as well, I point it out, but I also make it clear that I cannot guarantee his or her name will never be disclosed to others. In discussing this particular issue with a complainant or any other witness, I often use that as an opportunity to express the employer's commitment to protect its employees against retaliation and cite the company's anti-retaliation policy. I also ask the individual to immediately contact me or the company's HR function if there are any perceived issues of retaliation.
So retaliation is actually one of the most frequently alleged bases of discrimination with the EEOC. And some people don't realize that there are many different forms that retaliation can take. It can cover a wide array of actions or inactions, from the obvious, such as a termination or a demotion, to the less obvious, such as a reassignment of certain responsibilities, a transfer, a reprimand, a disparagement of the person, scrutinizing an employee's work more closely than that of others. And so in its guidance to employers, the EEOC has said that employers should make absolutely clear to its employees that it will not tolerate adverse treatment of employees because they provide information related to harassment complaints and should take measures to ensure that it does not occur. The EEOC also has specifically suggested that witnesses should not only be reminded of the policy, but that management should scrutinize the employee decisions affecting the complainant and witnesses during and after an investigation to ensure that such decisions are not based on retaliatory motives.
I found another very helpful suggestion by the EEOC is that an employer should consider asking the complainant how they would like to see the situation resolved. This information can be very helpful to an employer in terms of addressing what actions should be taken following an investigation. By way of example, a complainant may express a desire to move to another department in his or her interview, an action that an employer simply may not have otherwise considered for fear of a retaliation complaint. But if you're taking an action at the express wish of a complainant, you are plainly substantially reducing your risk of retaliation. In conducting an investigation, it's important to be mindful of issues that an employer may need to or should address at the conclusion of the investigation. For that reason, when concluding an investigation, I believe it's critical that an investigator assists the company in terms of pointing out potential areas for remediation so the company can minimize the risk of these issues occurring in the future.
Outside of identifying potential remedial measures and specifically addressing the alleged misconduct at issue, in your view, Julie, are there broader benefits to an employer conducting a thorough and timely investigation of these types of complaints?
Definitely. As an initial matter, from a legal perspective, if there is any related follow-on litigation down the line, the employer can state that it promptly initiated a thorough and impartial investigation and took prompt action and appropriate actions based on the findings of that review. Independent of that, you are fulfilling the expectations of shareholders, investors, and other stakeholders that you will act upon such complaints. You are telling your employees in particular that you take their concerns seriously, and having that communication will assist you in developing a better tone to retain talent and create a so-called speak-up culture where employees raise their hands and identify issues, and hopefully do so before they become longer-term or systematic issues. And of course, you're also sending a message to employees that you will not tolerate such misconduct.
And on that important note, I think that our time is up today. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.